Hi there, fellow ocean enthusiast. My name's Lauren and I'm a final year marine biology student at Plymouth University. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. Throughout history, Plymouth has been the starting point for many famous voyages and discoveries, and it acts as a honeypot for marine biologists from all over the world. This podcast is where we have conversations and tell the stories of local people and people further afield that dedicate their lives to the ocean. We're going to be speaking to scientists, divers, photographers, artists, students, you name it, just sharing our love for the ocean and discussing current topics within the field of marine biology, all while having a little bit of fun along the way. So, let's get going. It's difficult trying to come up with a little summary of you, because I was looking through everything you've done and I was like, I don't understand half of it and there's so much. So. Please don't be offended by the
not at all. I don't understand half of it either, so it's fine. You're not alone by a long way in that.
I think it's true to say as well, you've got more letters after your name than most people have in their name as well.
Yeah, more than in my name. That's something that happens if you stay in the game a long time.
Okay.
Yeah, it's accumulating things. You know, like... If you've got a bit of a passion for collecting something, so like, you know, you collect little ducks that fly across the wall, by the time you kind of get into the sort of late stages of a career, you've got a lot of ducks on the wall.
Wow.
And that's really what that's like.
Power. Well, longevity.
Yeah. It's longevity, yeah. I think it means I haven't been forced out of the game by the unpleasant circumstances of trying to win money to continue doing researches or things that are difficult in science. I've stayed in, which means I've got some letters after my name. Yeah.
You make it sound so sort of just like, oh yeah, I've got a few letters after my name.
Mm. Well, yeah, it is.
It's people from the West Midlands. We're very modest.
Yeah.
So, okay, some of those letters. There's a professional body called the Royal Society for Biology. And if you're a professional biologist, you can join that society. So if you're an engineer, there's a Royal Society for Engineers, and you know, you pay your money, you sign up, you can stick the letters after your name. Well, anybody who's up to about 35, 40, they're probably not even thinking about joining the club. Mm-hmm. But then when you get into mid-career, you think, well, okay, that club actually does good things for young scientists. So if I pay the money into that club and I help support that club, I'm helping young scientists, I'm helping careers with people. So when you hit that kind of phase in your career where you're not thinking, oh my God, can I keep going in this? You know, am I actually good enough to be able to go and get a permanent job? Am I actually good enough to build a group and a research group? And can I get that going? And you start thinking about what is this overall game like and what's going on and what do you need for this to continue in the future? You start thinking about things like, okay, this Royal Society for Biology, it provides grants for early career people. Mm-hmm. It stimulates careers. And, you know, if I get involved, I might even be able to get them to do some of my sort of science that I'm passionate about and keep my area of things that I'm really keen on going. So I join the society and I pay my money and I go to the meetings and I help with the society. Yeah, I get letters after my name. Now, why is that? That's because I've stayed in the game long enough. And that's really what I think a lot of that is about. So, yeah, letters. They don't mean very much. They don't mean you do smart stuff. They just mean that you're thinking in a slightly wider way about what's going on.
How did you get to in the game? So you keep saying, you know, I've been in the game a long time. Kind of where did you start? Did you always know that you wanted to be in the game as being a scientist? Or?
So how long have you got?
Brief overview.
As long as you want.
So, my parents took me on holidays to Wales when I was very small. And my father would say to me, explaining later on, when you were small, you'd get to about three and we'd have to watch you. And I went, what do you mean watch? He said, well, most parents, they could stick their kid on the sand, watch them building sandcastles and just go to sleep for a bit. And he went, not you. You would wander off. And he said, we'd find you in rock pools, digging up the animals. And he said, you know, if we'd go to people to visit, you wouldn't sit in the house and do stuff. You'd be in their gardens, digging up worms, grabbing beetles and bringing the beetles in and going, whoa, you should see what this does.
So my parents love that.
Yeah, they fenced off our back garden and just let me go in the garden. And Dad spent the whole day just, and I'd come back covered in mud. And so I'd had got this thing about life for a long time. And on those early holidays, I got the seashore and marine biology. And that developed from there. So I went to a primary school, Leymore Primary School, and I was the first kid, and actually a black lad, Max Jones, and me were the first two kids to go from that primary school to our grammar school in 12 years. So we didn't have academic achievement in our primary school. We had a lot of other things, but we didn't have academic achievement. Mm-hmm. And that school, 10 years ago, had a 9-foot fence topped with razor wire around it when I went to have a look at it. So it was a school that didn't think its students were going to go to academic achievement. So I went to the grammar school, and I was suddenly in this school with middle-class kids, and I didn't really fit in. So there was a kind of, there was trouble in the school because I didn't fit in with those kids. And there was trouble when I came home because I was wearing a blazer and short trousers from the grammar school and none of the other kids around there were.
Yeah, so, you're kind of in the middle of both.
Oh, I was really
like...
caught. Yeah, really caught. So I regularly got bullied a bit at both ends. And one of my dad's friends said to me at one point, you're going to have to do something with that lad of yours because he's getting people following him down the street and smacking him on the back of the head. And my dad said, it'll sort itself out, it won't be a problem. And then about 2 months later, the bloke came in and said to me dad, you're going to have to do something about that lad of yours because I've had to pull him off somebody and he wasn't going to stop. And my dad said, well, it's sorted, isn't it? And it was. It was absolutely sorted. So I went to the grammar school and it took a while for me to settle in, but I had a big advantage. So I was really good at sport. I was our county cross country and 1500, 800 metre champion. And I was within a second of winning the English schools, 1500 metres. I was the fourth fastest 14-year-old in the world at 1500 metres, at 14. So I used to do sports day and I could run around with these posh kids. And I could run on their shoulder talking to them, asking them how tired they were. And, you know, get a lot of enjoyment out of that.
I bet.
And I did that. I did that a lot.
How did you say? I'm tired yet.
I did. I'd say, how you going? You all right? Got another quarter of a mile to go here. It's getting hard, isn't it? And I used to get a huge amount of enjoyment out of that. And I used to even do that in county cross-country races. I'd run around with the guy who was going to finish second and talk to him. And knowing the effect that it was having when you're... Because it happened to me in national level races, somebody would run alongside me and you'd know that they might have more left than you. But if somebody's running alongside you and you're close to the edge and they're talking to you, it really doesn't do anything for your confidence. It really doesn't. It plays with it. I was also disruptive. So I don't know if you've been in school classes where they have blackboards that are made of material that you roll round.
Before my time.
And there are metal strips that hold the pieces of material together. Yeah. So big blackboards at the front of the classroom with material that you chalk on and wipe off.
Yeah.
And long strips, about 8 or 9 feet long, joined by metal bands. So you pull the bands down, get a new piece of board, and it just rolls round. So I was the kid, before the class starts, standing on a chair, grating chalk onto the metal bands at the top of the board, so that when the teacher pulls the board around, this chalk rains down on the teacher, and the whole class disintegrates, and it's just huge fun. And I was the kid.
I feel the teacher. That sounds horrendous.
I was the kid. We had a teacher who kept sweets in the drawer at the front of the class and locked the drawer. English teacher, And every day he'd set the work, open the drawer, pull his sweets out and suck sweets. So before one of his classes, we had woodwork. And I made wedges in woodwork so that when we came into the class before he arrived, I knocked these wedges into the drawer where his sweets were. And again, he's trying to get his sweets out and he can't get the drawer out because it's wedged with these wedges. And again, the whole class disintegrates. So
that's quite clever, actually.
I did loads of stuff like that. We had a little group at school who were trying to do things that were a bit more outrageous. We had a guy called Miklasovic who bought some pens, the El Marco pens. And I kept seeing El Marco written all the way around the school in places you wouldn't believe, like 12 feet up on a column in the main hall. And I got called in to see the headmaster one day, and I sat down in front of the headmaster's desk, and El Marco was written on the front of the headmaster's desk. And of course, a few of us knew who was doing it, but that kind of gave him massive street cred. And I got lots of street cred for the wedges and the chalk and things like that. But I wasn't really academic. I was always in the top set, but I was never the top end of the top set. I did enough to be top set.
Yeah.
And then we went through O-levels, and I was kind of... I talked to my mum about what I was going to do, and we talked about working in a bank or management in industry. And we discussed stuff, and she said, I'll stay on for your A-levels, do some A-levels, and then go and get into a job. And we'll think about that when you get your A-levels done. So I started A-levels, and I got into my first year of A-levels, and the biology teacher came in one day, and he called me out of the class, and I thought, well, this is weird. I haven't done anything wrong, so I'm getting the blame here for something I haven't done. So I came out of the class ready to...
Defend,
yeah. And he said to me, that homework you did last week? And I went, yeah. And I thought, I actually tried. What the hell's gone wrong? Have I just got completely the wrong end of the stick and I've screwed up? And he went, it's good. And I thought, why have you pulled me out of a class to tell me the work's good? That's ridiculous. I said, oh, thank you, sir. Can I go back in now? And he went, no, you've not got this. He said, it's really good. And I went, oh, that's nice, sir. So he said, no, you're still not getting this. And I went, oh, what do you mean then? He said, this is good enough to go to any university in the country. And I went, yeah, like Oxford or Cambridge. And he went, yes, Oxford or Cambridge. And it kind of took me from one place and put me in another place. And I couldn't talk for a bit. And he was like, seriously? And he went, yes, this is Oxford or Cambridge work. And he said, I know you don't try. I know you can't be bothered. I know you do enough so that you don't stand out. He said, but you've got the ability to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And I thought, yeah, okay, fine. And I went home and I told my mum. And my mum went, you're going to Oxford or Cambridge. She said, what it takes, you're doing it. Because
every mum's dream, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't just that. So she said, look around you. She said, that lad, I won't name his name, he's got waterproof sleeves. And he's got waterproof sleeves because he wipes his nose on his sleeves all the time. And that family, their kids don't wear shoes because they just ain't got the money to wear shoes. And she said, if you go to Oxford or Cambridge, your life will not be like that. So I went back to the teacher and I said, OK, my mum says I've got to go and do this. And he said, right, there's coaching for the entrance exams on Tuesday and Wednesday lunchtime and after school on Thursday. If you're going to do it, you're going to do that. So I did the coaching, I did the entrance exam, and I went to Cambridge. Got my degree in Cambridge. Was taught by a man called Richard Barnes, who is an exceptional ecologist. While I was at school, we had an outward bound centre in North Wales, and I went and did bits of marine biology and loved it.
And what was your undergrad in, sorry?
Natural sciences.
Natural sciences,
zoology,
yeah.
Was my main subject.
Yeah.
And I learned to scuba dive while I was at university as well. And I learnt how animals use energy from this guy, Richard Barnes. He was really weird. He had a perm, and he had a kind of half afro perm. And he had all his keys on a leather thong around his neck. And when he was giving you supervisions, he'd lay the keys on the desk. And he'd gradually lean back so the keys dropped off the edge of the desk one by one, and you'd find yourself looking at these keys and not listening to what the bloke was saying. And he'd wear bow ties in the lectures, and every now and then he'd have a rotating bow tie that was clearly on a button in his pocket.
Sounds like I need to up my lecture game.
It was weird.
I think you do, yeah.
With bow ties.
Spinning bow ties, yeah.
And I met him again because I went back to Cambridge to work for the Antarctic Survey, and I talked to him a bit then, and I said, what was the rotating bow tie thing about? He said, I could always tell people who were listening to what I was saying because they would notice the bow tie. He said, and I liked people who listened to what I said and didn't just write down by rote what I was saying, but were thinking about what I was doing. And he said, I can pick the students out with the rotating bow tie, and I know that I want those students to be focused on because they're thinking and not just doing. So he was doing it for reasons. He was doing all of this for reasons. So I learned to scuba dive. I learned about marine biology. And then I finished at Cambridge. And in my final year, the head of a research group, an agriculture research group called John Treherne, came to me and said, with another guy who I'd worked with, a professor, Simon Mattrell, really bright guy, they said, we've got a friend in New York who's got a PhD on fireflies. And we talked to him, and if you want the PhD, it's yours. And I said to him, no, sorry, John, I'm not clever enough to do a PhD. I just don't have it. I've looked around the department, and I'm not like the PhD students in this department. I said, I can go to this guy, you can turn the radio on, and he can not only tell you what the music is, he can tell you who wrote it, he can tell the orchestra that's playing it, and I can go to this guy, talk to him about Greek gods. He knows all the Greek gods and the Roman gods and what they did, and I mean, I just don't have any of that. And he said, there are five or six things you need to do research. He said, they've got education. You've got four of the other five in spades. You just don't know you've got it. So I then said, that's very kind of you to say.
What were those characters?
The characteristics. Yeah. Genuine inquisitiveness, wanting to know how things work, is the biggest. Far and away the biggest is inquisitiveness. A second one is a determination to see a job through and not be put off and not be stopped by it. A third one is a genuine ability to see things in a slightly different way. And he said to me a few times, you know, we teach you this. He said, and we get asked questions about it as we go along. He said, you'll ask me questions that I don't get from other people because for some reason in your background, you've got something a bit odd. So that kind of quirkiness and slight difference is a big thing in doing science. And the other one is communication and being able to articulate what you're trying to put over in a way that people can understand, because that helps you get information backwards and forwards with people. So I didn't do the PhD. I went back home and I worked for a year in a steel foundry, and I did a few jobs in a steel foundry, and I got offered a post in management in the steel foundry. And I'd worked on the reheating plants, and I'd done three shifts a day, 2 till 10, 10 till 6, 6 till 2. So I'd been going in at 10 at night, working 3 till 6, and coming out and doing all that stuff. Mm-hmm. With that absolutely amazing group of people. We'd got Jamaicans, Sikhs, Pakistanis, white people, Scots, Irish, and they all worked together in a way that I found really kind of interesting, gave me massive insights. We had a guy with a glass eye, and when we had our lunch or your break and you're eating, he put his sandwiches down on a chair and pull his eye out, and he put it on his sandwiches while he went to the toilet and say, keep an eye on that for me. And so there were kind of weird things going on there. And then the management came in, and the management really didn't treat the workforce very well, and I didn't like that. So while I was there, there was a pay round going on, and the management came in and told them what they were going to pay these guys. And one of the Jamaican guys said, explain to me how you do this, how you get to this figure. And the manager said, I'm sorry, but you won't understand it. It's complicated. And this Jamaican guy went, him just got a degree from Cambridge. You tell him tell us. And the manager went, no, I don't think we could get to that. And that said to all the workforce that it wasn't that we couldn't get to a point whereby we could understand what they were trying to do. It was they didn't want us to know what they were trying to do and why they were trying to do it. So they came in and they said, look, we've looked at you. The manager said, we'd like you to do a management training program. We'd like you to be a manager after a while. And I looked at this guy and said, I'm really sorry, but I don't think in 10 years' time I can be you. So I then went back home and thought, well, what am I going to do? So I then went, okay, I've got to try this research thing because I've been told I could be good at it. And I actually missed sort of working on problems intellectually. So I looked for PhDs and I looked for ones that were applied. And I got a PhD a program on aquaculture and in Portsmouth. And I grew an animal called an abalone. Now, an abalone is a big snail. It's a big marine snail. In California and Japan, they grow 30 centimetres long. They're a big delicacy. If you buy them in Paris in restaurants, they're 50 euros a kilo. They're big money. And they live in the Channel Islands, but they don't come any further north than that. And I did 4-5 years working on these, how to grow them the fastest, whether we could grow them in heated water in from power station effluent and places like that. And I worked out a lot of the optimum growth conditions. And then I'm probably one of the few people to eat their PhD, because at the end of it, we had a couple of parties and we cooked all the animals that I'd grown, and we ate the PhD. But I then also got into how do animals use energy, how do they function, how do they interact with the environment, and I wanted to get more into how the environment affects what animals can do. And the best places to do that are extreme environments, because you can see the limits. So when a job came up working in the Antarctic Survey, doing animal energetics, I had to apply for it. And I got it, and here we are, 30-odd years later, I'm still gripped by the questions about what is it about that environment that means these animals here can do this and they can't do that? And what is it there that means they can do this and they can't do that? So why is it that fish can swim way faster in the tropics than in the polar regions? Why is it the development of eggs takes 10 times longer than it should do? Not 10 times longer than in temperate zones, but if you look at how much slowed it should be because of temperature at zero, they're even slower than that. They're 5 to 10 times slower than they should be for the effect of temperature. And that's because when you get close to 0 degrees, water starts to freeze and it gets sticky and it gets more viscous and it affects the way that cells work. And it's much, much harder to make protein, and protein is growth. And so development, especially of embryos, is dramatically slowed because most of the protein they make is gash and they have to break it up again and remake it. And there's this cycle to make the protein that you need. So those sorts of questions you can only ask at low temperatures. And I've been gripped by questions like, why do you get sea spiders that are over 50 centimetres across in the Antarctic? And the biggest ones we've got in the UK are a centimetre and a half. They're 5,000 times heavier in the Antarctic than they are in temperate zones. Questions like that, because to be a scientist, you have to be inquisitive. You have to want to ask the questions. There are so many questions like that in extreme environments that where you might think you start asking questions and your cup empties, mine just gets more full and it kind of overflows and there are too many questions. I can't ask all the questions I want to ask.
That's probably my favourite thing about science, is you continually uncover your own ignorance.
You do?
So you'll answer a question, but yeah, then it'll open up, just span out.
So it almost comes back to all the letters after your name. I know more now that I don't know very much than I knew 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 30 years ago. I know more things that I don't know anything about.
That's reassuring, because I often sit in lectures and think that I sit and think I feel like I know absolutely nothing, and the more I learn about, I don't know, take something like biodiversity, the more it confuses me, and I'm glad that you experienced that as well.
It's because clearly we weren't wearing spinning bow ties.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think one of the things you have to become comfortable with if you can have a career in science, right, two big things. One is you have to be comfortable with the idea that you just don't know about stuff. And it's kind of one of the biggest problems, because most people in most careers know about the stuff they do, and they can be really confident about the stuff they do. So somebody, an engineer, they learn the principles of engineering. They might be building buildings. They know how the principles work and they know how the structures work. As a scientist, every time you're doing a piece of science, you're asking a different question. And it's insecure. It is real insecurity. And you have to have enough inquisitiveness or enough confidence to just keep going, because it can burn you out. Mm-hmm. It really can burn you out, because it's hard work. And the second thing you have to be really good with is knockbacks, because you'll do a piece of work, and I don't know any other career where you do a piece of work, you might publish it in a paper, in a journal, and then people will have a go at it, and you'll go and present it at a conference, people will have a go at it. I don't see anybody, I don't know, building houses where people go along and say, well, that was a bit crap, wasn't it? Or why did you get that wrong? Or did you think about doing it this way instead of that way? Or, well, if you look at this in a different way, you wouldn't have built the house like that, would you? Whereas a scientist, all those questions come up. And everything you do for the rest of the time that you are in the game, people can come and say, why did you do that? I wrote a paper in 1992 that somebody this year has come to me and gone, I think you got that wrong. So that's 30 years ago, and somebody's come to me and gone, I think you got that wrong. And they haven't come to me to say that because they want to go, hey, you're a prof, I'm going to have a pop at you. Right. They've done that because they're interested. They're inquisitive. They want to know about this thing. And I did some work on it 30 years ago, and they've read it, and they don't think it works like that. They think it works in a different way. And what they want to do is engage me in a conversation about this part of the world outside.
So it's almost a positive thing instead of a personal thing.
You are bang on. And when you start seeing that criticism as a positive thing, and your lack of knowledge as a positive thing, because it means, wow, I've got so many things I can go and find out about, then suddenly the game becomes something way more interesting to play than with your Xbox or whatever you're playing with, because you've got the world to play with. You have got biodiversity to play with. All those things you're sitting in there thinking, my God, I don't know about that. It's right. If anybody in your group with you is standing around going, oh, yeah, I understand that, they're fools. They are absolute fools, because I'll guarantee you they don't. If some of your mates say to you, I've got this aspect of biodiversity, bring them up to me and have a chat with me. We'll sort them out. Because I'll guarantee they don't.
It's too big to understand.
It is. It is too big to understand. And you have to get that, I think. I mean, okay, there are lots of scientists who don't get it. I don't have a lot of respect for them, because I don't think they're the ones who are going to do really good science. I think the ones who are going to do really good science are the ones who know they don't know about stuff, and the ones who want to know about stuff. And that has got to be, for me, the real driving aspect. There was a really famous physicist called Richard Feynman, and There were two quotes of his that I remember. One is, he was asked at a conference about quantum mechanics. And he said, okay, you know, I am one of the leaders of quantum mechanic theory. He said, there are 13 people in the world currently who claim to understand quantum mechanics. He said, I know for a fact 12 of them are wrong. He said, and the 13th, I'm really absolutely not sure about whether that person understands quantum mechanics. Of course, that was him. And the second question was, when you die, Professor Feynman, and you go to meet God, what are you going to ask him? He said, well, I'm pretty confident he'll be able to answer any questions on quantum mechanics, so I'm not going to ask him about quantum mechanics. But I'm also absolutely certain he won't have a clue with fluid dynamics. So I think we'll have discussions about fluid dynamics. And I think that shows why he was a scientist for all his life. because he recognised there were questions to ask. And science is about asking the questions and trying to find out ways of getting information about that. So the inquisitiveness is really what you need for the basis for a science career. It's a long answer to your question, but yeah, I hope that was all right.
Yeah, reassuring. Really was, yeah.
So that's how I got into being a scientist.
I have to wrap it up there, I think. No, yeah. So
can we talk about BAS, British Antarctic Survey?
We can.
Because that's it's a part of the world that most people don't have a concept of what it's like and will certainly never travel to. So just please tell us about your work at BAS.
So one, you can get cruises to the Antarctic. And if you've got, I think the cheapest ones are about 1,500 quid. You want to go on a cruise if you can to the Antarctic, because you will see things that you won't see anywhere else. If you get a cruise onto the Antarctic Peninsula, you will see great whales. You'll see penguin colonies of several thousand birds. You'll see albatrosses in large numbers. And you will see ice in a way that you just will never have seen ice before. You'll see 600 feet cliffs of ice, and you'll see the sea freezing in a way that you won't see it freezing anywhere else. And you'll just see environments that you won't experience without going there. But I'm not in the Antarctic for that. I'm in the Antarctic for understanding why the animals are different. The Antarctic Survey is an organisation of 450, 500 people. We run a big ship. You'll have all seen the Sir David Attenborough. And we run 5 aircraft, and we run 2 permanent stations and 2 summer service stations. One of the summer service ones runs all year round, but people aren't on it in the winter at Halley. We do science. We do lots of science, and we facilitate science for other groups around the country and abroad. So we have Dutch people, Italians, Malaysians, Chileans working on our stations regularly. And we do everything from space weather. So we have a group working on the output from the sun and the particles released from the sun and how they affect satellites. So they can predict when you need to turn your satellites off so they won't get damaged by radiation across space. From that group, we have upper atmosphere chemists, we have climate scientists, we have ice sheet scientists, we have weather scientists, we have glaciologists, we have oceanographers, we have sea ice scientists, we have terrestrial biologists, a couple. We have a big group that works on ocean ecosystems and looks at the food webs, the flow of material, looks at carbon deposition, looks at microplastics in the environment. And we have a group of seabed biologists, and I'm one of those seabed biologists. And yeah, okay, I do like and love going to the Antarctic. I've been to the polar regions 22 times. If I was going there for the buzz of the environment, I would have probably gone 5 or 6. So the rest is for the science questions.
How long were you there for when you go?
My shortest trip was 48 minutes, and my longest trip was 3.5 months.
48 minutes.
48 minutes sounds wild. What happened there?
So I was working on one of our stations just north of the Antarctic Circle. And we had a problem with the ship that was meant to relieve us. It broke down. It broke down about 3 days away from us. And we'd got a visitor on the station at the time who was in his 70s. And there was some concern that we might get wintered in. So we might get stuck for the winter. And that was seen as something we really didn't want to happen. So we asked the military to help us. And they sent the Endurance over at high speed. So the Endurance sailed flat out for 2 days to get within helicopter range. It then put the Lynx helicopters out and picked up 5 of us off the station with the Lynx helicopters. And we flew back with the Lynx, strapped into the webbing in the back of the helicopter with no doors on the side of the helicopter. And the pilots had fun. They turned the helicopters on their side. We were kind of staring straight down at ice on the sea, yeah, going past at high speed and stuff like that. And we got back to the Endurance and they took us up and down the side of the ship so that we could wave to the captain and stuff like that. And they popped us on the Endurance and we sailed flat out across the Antarctic Peninsula, and the helicopters flew us off to Marsh Station, which was a Chilean station. And it met our aeroplane flying down from the Falklands into the Antarctic. So we got on the aeroplane, the Dash 7, and flew to Rothera, which is the base I work mostly from now. And we got off that plane while they refueled the plane. And I stood on hard ground in Antarctica at Rothera Station for 48 minutes. And then they put us back on the plane and flew us out and back to the UK. And it was partly to show that if there's an emergency, how the emergency system works, to test the emergency systems. And I was just fortunate enough to be involved in that. But yeah, I mean, the environment is fantastic. And if you're an environmental biologist, it is unreal. So I've been within 15 feet of a pack of killer whales dismembering a seal. And that does put the hair up on your neck. I've been in a boat spy hopped by a big male killer whale where it's come out of the water and you're standing up in the boat looking up at the animal's eye while that animal is staring down at you. And I've been in a boat where a humpback's gone underneath the boat and had its tail out one side and its head out the other, and you just see a wall of grey as you go past, and the scale of the animals is really unbelievable. So some of the experiences are really things you can't get in many places. If you're scuba diving, and we're actually not allowed to do this now, but we used to be able to do it. If you're scuba diving and you're in the water with an iceberg, if that ice has come from a big glacier and it's been deep, so a kilometre deep, the pressure fuses all of the ice crystals together. And it removes the air, makes the air really, really small. So the ice looks like glass. And when you're diving, you can't see it. So as a diver, you can put your hand out in the water and it stops in the water. And you see the ice maybe half a metre beyond where your hand is. And you can blow bubbles and you can watch the bubbles going up the side of this iceberg. But you can't see the edge of the iceberg. It's just like somebody's vitrified the water. It's like something from a sci-fi film. And whenever we had these proper blue ice icebergs, 15, 20 years ago when we were allowed to do it, I would go diving with the blue ice icebergs purely just for the experience of being in the water with ice that you won't see anywhere else. And again, the phytoplankton blooms are more intense in the nearshore Antarctic than anywhere else, but the environment allows things to grow big, and so you can see phytoplankton. So you, as a scuba diver,
uh-huh,
I can lie on the seabed, and some of the big chain-forming diatoms look like green strings in the water. So there's been quite a few times where I've been on a dive, and at 5 metres depth, 6 metres depth, when we're doing our decompression stop at the end of the dive, I'm lying on my back and I'm looking at the sun because I can see these green strings in the water. And a couple of times the other divers thought something's gone wrong and come over to me and given me a shake to see I'm all right, and I've, you know, given the okay signal. But as a biologist, I'm kind of lying there thinking, my God, they're phytoplankton. And I'm seeing phytoplankton. And things like that just blow my mind away. Just literally blow my mind away. I mean, okay, I've been in the water with 100 fur seals and they've come and pulled me through the water and they mess with your experiments and they'll play games with you. And it's like being in amongst a pack of dogs that are playing. And that's great fun. But it's the things that make the environment different to me, like the sort of giant phytoplankton and the ice that just makes the world a kind of different place, that I they're the things I really like. But again, for me, the reason I go back again and again and again is why are the cells different, and why, you know, what difference does it make having antifreeze in your cells to stop them freezing? It makes your cells do different things. Again, why do we have giant animals? Why don't we have any big crabs and lobsters in the Antarctic? What is it that stops them being there? Why are there no sharks in the Antarctic? What is it that stops them being there? What takes their place? Why do we have 24% of the world's sea spider species in the Antarctic on 10% of the world's seabed? Why are they twice to three times as diverse as the rest of the planet? Why do we have 20,000 species living on the seabed in the Antarctic, as many as Europe, when everybody thinks animals don't live at low temperature? Well, bugger me, they do, and loads of them. So the questions for me are all about, well, how can they do that? What is it that's different about them that allows them to do that? Why are there different animals here than there? And you know, if I live to be 105, I'll still be interested in those questions.
When you see something cool, I'm guessing the first thing you want to do is go and tell people. So how do you communicate when you're out there? How do you communicate with people, like outside of Antarctica and stuff?
When I first went to the Antarctic, the communication we had with the outside world was through a telex. So I had 100 words a week to write to my wife on a telex. And I had 100 words one week and she had 100 words back the next, and then I had 100 words. So we had 400 words a month. And you would write your telex out and give it to the telex operator, who would type it into the telex machine. So everything you said to the outside world was known by everybody on station. And everything your partner said to you that came back the other way was known by everybody on station. And not only that, was known by the people in Cambridge at the other end, because there was a telex operator on the other end. Okay. So the second year I was in the Antarctic, my wife's father died and she didn't tell me, because she didn't want me to know and she didn't want everybody else to know, because there was nothing that I could do. The ship coming out was 6 weeks away, so that was just nothing we could do. And my sons, we could pay for telephone calls, £4 a minute, which in the early 1990s was a lot of money. You'd be talking £20 a minute now, £25 a minute.
Crazy.
It is. So on my son's fourth birthday, I phoned home and I spent £150 listening to my son cry on the phone because his dad wasn't there to give him a hug on his birthday.
Oh.
And the next telex I got in was, do not ever phone home again, from my wife. I have spent 4 days trying to calm that kid down. So I misjudged that massively. Then we got faxes, where you could write on a one page of a fax, stick it in the fax machine, and they didn't type that in. So they didn't actually read your fax. But the fax operator took the faxes on and off the machine, so if you weren't actually in the room with the fax operator at the time, they would read all the faxes. So coming off in the UK end, you knew that even though the organisation was saying, oh no, this is all confidential and private, come on, you know the fax operator's reading all the faxes.
That'd be a great job.
Getting all the
gossip.
All the way around the Antarctic, all around those stations with people who've been cut off from society for 3, 4, 5, and in the wintertime, 6 months.
Great job.
Then we moved to computers with emails. And my wife sold our house while I was away 1 year. And I got an email saying, I've sold the house and I've put a bid in on another one that's been accepted. And I was sitting next to a builder and, oh my God. And the builder went, what's going on? I said, well, my wife sold the house and bought another one. And this builder said, my wife did that to me. I'd give her a right slap when I got home. It's like, so I went, no, it's all right. We've been talking about selling the house and buying another one. And we know the sort of houses we want. We've looked at a few and okay, it's not one of those, but it's something that's in the list. So I'm actually quite pleased because it means I've not got to get involved in all of that.
It saved you a bunch of admin.
It saved me a bunch of admin. So those sorts of things happened. And now, we don't have big bandwidth in the Antarctic, but we do have social media at least some of the time. So we can get in touch with people that way. But I've traditionally done most of my communication to the outside world through interactions with journalists. So I've done a lot of TV interviews, I've done a lot of media interviews, newspaper articles, and I have a network of journalists that I interact with. So when something cool happens, I get in touch with them and we have a phone call, or we go and have a meeting with them. And then I've done things like, I put a lot of input into Frozen Planet and programmes like that. And I've been an advisor on, I don't know, 8 or 10 big TV and film programmes about marine environments. And I gave the Christmas lectures in 2004, which had an audience of about 3.5 million. And I lectured about the Antarctic and how people did work in the Antarctic, how animals and plants function in the Antarctic, and then probably one of the first televised lectures about climate change. So my third lecture was about climate change and what it's doing, how it's doing it, and how if we don't do something about it, we are buggered. And that was in 2004.
Was that specifically about organisms in the polar regions, or just generally speaking?
The first two lectures were about the polar regions. Mm. The climate change one was about climate change.
Just in general.
It was about, yeah, what causes climate change. Because at the time, there was a huge amount of anti-climate change disinformation going on. And most people hadn't heard about climate change and just didn't realise there was a problem. So there was a small group. There was a band or group of scientists who knew that it was bad. Jim Lovelock was vitriolic about it. He's the guy who built the Daisy World model, one of the first global modelling exercises, and he did a whole bunch of some of the most amazing science, wacky science. The group he worked with invented microwaves in the 1950s, and the reason they invented microwaves was they were trying to cryopreserve animals, and they could do animals like shrews and mice, freeze them, warm them up, and they'd be fine. But they couldn't do anything bigger than about a gerbil or a hamster. Rabbits came out and were alive but died. And they worked out the reason for the problem was they couldn't warm these things up at the same rate all the way through the animal. So they invented microwaves to do that, so that the animals they were preserving, cryopreserving, would be able to survive the rewarming exercise.
That's crazy.
It's crazy, yeah.
I had no idea.
And he did that. And he was a big climate change advocate in the 1990s and early 2000s. And I was one of those people as well. So I made the third lecture in my Royal Institution series about climate change. And then after you give those lectures, they have an agreement with Korea, Japan and Brazil to go and give a similar set of lectures in those countries that are televised.
Yeah.
So I gave that climate change lecture to live audiences of up to about 2,500 in the audience. Big interactive lectures with kids coming up on the stage, doing demos, and huge amounts of fun.
But just that was a lot of fun, yeah.
Massive amounts of fun. But then a big climate change lecture at the end, and the Koreans syndicated their recorded lectures around Asia to an estimated audience of about 80 million, and the Japanese had an audience estimated to be about 10 million, and the Brazilians had an audience estimated to be about 25 million. So my climate change lectures went to audiences of maybe 130 to 150 million people. And because I knew that was going to happen, I wanted to give a big climate change message in the lectures, because I feel it's our big problem of our age. And actually, you know, I'm getting towards the end of my career now. It is the biggest problem of this generation and the next generation and the generation after that, because what we are doing now is going to affect the lives of people in 100 years' time.
Do you have any sort of words of hope about that? Because I often sit around and think, oh, there's not that much that can be done a lot of the time, and I get quite down about it. I think a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any positive
I get down about it. I think we've gone past the point whereby we can avoid really bad things happening. We are now committed to things worse than what are going on in Pakistan at the moment, with 30 million people pushed out of their homes by floods. It is going to get worse than that. There are going to be large areas of the planet that are basically uninhabitable, and those populations are either going to migrate, or we are going to see large numbers of people die. And I don't think we can do anything about that. That is going to happen. That is going to happen. If we don't want it to get even worse than that, we have to do things, and we have to do them now. In my Christmas lectures, 2004, I was saying things like, we have got to get really big actions in the next 10 to 20 years, or the world will face catastrophes equivalent to nuclear wars. And we are now in the stage whereby if we don't do things now, we will be facing environmental catastrophes equivalent to nuclear wars. We will be killing off hundreds of millions of people if we don't do something about climate change now. I am way from convinced that we will do what we need to do. I don't think humans will go out of existence. I think we have the chance of losing big parts of society, losing huge amounts of society. I think people don't care enough, and they don't realise what's going on. And it's a human trait. So Easter Island has no people living on it. And it did up until about 400 years ago. And that society had five main tribes. And they lived by making canoes out of the trees on the island and fishing and using the canoes. And there came a time where those tribes could see there were only 100 trees left on the island. And if you cut those trees down, there ain't going to be any people in 50 years' time or 100 years' time. But if you don't cut the trees down now, your life is going to be significantly impaired. They cut the trees down and made the island uninhabitable. We are at the 100 trees phase. We are there now. And if we don't do something about it, we will be making large parts of this planet where we live now uninhabitable. And I don't see anybody taking that seriously enough. I certainly don't see our governments taking it seriously enough.
It's frustrating. I just don't think it's communicated that well a lot of the time. I know a lot of people that don't.
I think it is communicated well, though. I think it really is. I think people are just inherently selfish, and they see it as something that's like long off. It's not going to affect me now.
But there's probably a bit of that, but I also think people that aren't necessarily in the field or that interested in general, there's a lot of misinformation, and they tend to latch onto things like plastic straws, for example, and not everything is talked about equally. That biodiversity loss isn't really talked about in the same way that global warming is. I hear people all the time saying on a warm day, oh, global warming, this is great. I'm thinking, this is not what it means. There's a lot of misconception. And
you are so right.
It's worrying.
You are so right. And it's the kind of atavistic nature of the individual that means we won't do what we need to do. So in those Christmas lectures, we did some surveys, and we did these kind of oblique surveys. So you ask people to prioritise things and rank things and whatever. And saving the planet was lower on the list than giving up soap operas.
Are you joking? I love EastEnders, but
people would not give up soap operas to save the planet. They would not take a penny on income tax to save the planet. So when you said you were depressed about it, I'm depressed about human nature, because I don't think people, as you said, will give things up. So for instance, I have a mobile phone. I keep my mobile phone until it literally stops working before I replace it. So my last one was 7 years old, and it just wouldn't function anymore before I replaced it. We have a car in our family, but we only have one car, and my wife drives it. We do 7,000 miles a year in our car. I ride a bike, and we purposely bought a house within cycling range of where I work, so I can ride a bike, and I ride a bike everywhere. I don't do any other transport. I've stopped going to conferences where I need to fly. And I'll go to conferences in Europe, I go by train. So I've changed the way I live, I now eat probably 60% vegetarian. I can't bring myself to give up bacon sandwiches. I just cannot give myself to give up bacon sandwiches.
No, that's understandable.
Yeah. So I'm trying to change what I do, because I think, although I know that what I do as an individual is, it's like it's shaving the shavings off the shavings. It's so small that it is going to have no effect. But I also think if we don't say to people, well, okay, if enough people shave the shavings, then we actually do make an effect.
Yeah.
So if I don't buy into that and I know what's going on, we have no chance. We have no chance. So I buy into that. And then I do preach to people and I say things like we've said on this podcast. We aren't in the Last Chance Saloon. We're watching the walls of the Last Chance Saloon falling down. It is disintegrating around us and we have to do things about it. So taking the brakes off shale gas, what the hell are we doing? I mean, what are we thinking about? Yeah, okay, our economy's in trouble. We need to do things about the economy. People's lives are going to be worse if we don't take the brakes off shale gas. That's fine. We help people now. We kill a billion people in 50 years' time.
When you have these conversations with people, how do they usually take it? Because I find that often they think, oh, you know, can you stop now? It's a bit much, or you're being a little bit overdramatic. I don't know whether you've ever faced with that.
So I do. Yeah, I have, and I've had a lot of that over the years. And I've had people say to me, oh, you climate scientist, you're only doing that. And I'm actually not a climate scientist. I'm an adaptations biologist. But I see enough of the climate science to know what is going on. And they say, you climate scientist, you're only doing it. So do you get money to do your research? My response to that has always been, do you not think that if I could go out and prove that climate change and the science behind climate change was wrong, that I wouldn't go and do that? I would be the most feted scientist on the planet. I'd win Nobel Prizes easier than anybody else because I'd be proving what all this other science that's been put out there, all the stuff from ice cores showing carbon dioxide changing and the temperature changing in the same way over the last million years, all this stuff on the physics of how gases in the atmosphere let heat through but don't let heat out. All of that science, I'd be proving that was wrong.
You'd be a famous millionaire.
I would be the most famous scientist on the planet. So if you're arguing we're doing it to get recognition, any scientist working in that field who could disprove it would disprove it, because that would be the biggest thing you could ever do. So to say the scientists are bullshitting you, that is just so wrong that it's not even worth considering. So there are lots of things, but I also think people who know, it's beholden to you to not back down on that argument. Mm-hmm. You've got to, because the oil companies and the people making money out of things that are increasing climate change are spreading huge amounts of disinformation around the world. They're trying to muddy the waters because they want to make the biggest profits they can make now. And that is just wrong on every way you look at it, morally, any way you want to look at it. It's only right if you want to make more money all the time and you don't care about killing people and destroying the planet.
Yeah.
That was blockbuster.
Yeah. Wow. It's hard to hear it, I suppose. Yeah.
But it's a message that needs to be heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's quite hard to say.
I imagine. Just on a slightly cheery note, because we've got to kind of wrap up the podcast, we have a little game called Creature of the Week.
Creature of the Week?
Ooh, yeah. Exciting.
So Creature was the character in Harry Potter. Was a house elf.
Yes, Dobby's sort of the...
Well,
the
Dobby's equivalent
Dobby.
Yeah. So Creature of the Week has got to be a house elf, has it?
Oh, if you find them in the Antarctic, then maybe.
So, my favourite creature...
We've got questions for you, and you've got to guess.
I'm going to give you some clues, and you have to try and guess the... It'll be the common name, but I'm not sure how good my clues
are. Let's do it.
Okay. So, the creature resides in the Southern Ocean. Got it, yeah?
I get a guess, do I?
No, you can do it.
Krill.
Max length of the organism is 9.5 centimetres. I think they range from like 7 to 9.5. Slow growing. Do you want to?
Glyptonotus, the isopod, a giant isopod.
Depth range 0.5 metres.
0 to 5 metres.
Oh, sorry.
0 to 5 metres.
It has a fan-like pectoral fin.
Ah, so there's a range of fish. Harpagifer antarcticus, the plunderfish.
Yes.
Oh.
Easy. Light work. There was some more.
You got two questions early there. Congrats.
Yeah. I think that was probably one of the best rounds we've had.
Yeah, they actually live a bit deeper than that as well.
Do they?
Yeah, you can collect them down to 25 or 30 metres. They're rarer as you get deeper. But
oh, wow.
The explanation of them generally says they're very shallow.
Okay.
Most places they're not very shallow because the top 3-4 metres freezes in the winter, so they don't live in the top 3-4 metres.
Right.
But yeah, I must have collected hundreds of those in my time as an Antarctic biologist because they're one of our lab rats. And we've got 50 of them in our aquarium in Cambridge at the moment.
Good job you guessed it then.
It would have been a bit embarrassing if you'd have got down to the end and said, oh, it's the plunderfish. Yeah, there were people in our organisation, if they heard that, they would have been taking the rise out of me for a long, long time.
Thank you so much. That was brilliant.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that was awesome. Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking me. Yeah, brilliant.
All right.
Enjoyed it.
Cheers.